Greetings, humans. Welcome to another edition of the Sensitive Skin Podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of SensitiveSkinMagazine.com. I had a job about 20 years ago in this back when the internet was sort of just getting its feet. And we worked for this one woman, and we just loved the way she used to say, .com. She used to say, .com after everything. Anyway, our guest today is the wonderful and delightful Eve Packer. Eve is a New York City-based poet, and she's got some very interesting stories to tell us. And at the end, she will read us a few poems. I am currently in the North Bay of beautiful California, and the air is getting smoky, and the power is going to drop out anytime soon. It's 12 p.m. Do you know where your children are? I don't know where mine are. I mean, I vaguely know where they are, but I don't know exactly where they are. I think they're okay. But, yeah, fires, blackouts, it's the new normal. Oh, yeah, one more thing I should mention is that this conversation was recorded in mid-July, so it was shortly after the passing of the great Steve Cannon, and so we started off, Eve and I, talking about Steve. Yeah, so it's a little dated, but that way. But anyway, it's still good. But you might be wondering why we're talking about that. A number of the upcoming podcasts were recorded over the summer when I had the time to do them. So hopefully we don't talk too much about political stuff that seems like it. What? That was just like 6 weeks ago? I thought that was like 3 years ago. So much has happened since then. So at any rate, just so there's no confusion about that. All right. Anyway, I'm going to keep it short today. So here is my discussion with the delightful Eve Packer. So how are you?
How am I? Well, I'm amazed that I was able to do this. So that's the great part. And as I said, I was looking and I thought, those are my bookshelves. I must be photographing myself. And you have things pinned to the wall, which I sort of do too. So,
yeah. No, this is me. That's you. I'm looking at you.
Yeah. Okay. So it's been a big week. As you know, Steve Cannon passed really late Saturday, very early Sunday morning, the 7th. And there was a huge do for him on Sunday at Bowery. I'm sure you heard all about it.
Seen a lot of the pictures on Facebook, heard people talking about it.
I don't know how to send my photos to Facebook. That's something else I got to figure out. But it was a great event, as I thanked some people, and one of them was Bob Holman. And he wrote back, very sweet, and he said it was a truly gathering of the tribes.
Aww.
It was truly a gathering of the tribes, and it was. I mean, just you would have liked to be there. It was a great, wonderful event, and his family was there, and they were astounding and marvelous. Yeah, some of them, anyway. About 12 people from his family.
Wow. There. Yeah, I don't think I've ever met anyone from his family before.
I hadn't met anybody from his anyway, his New Orleans, Baltimore, Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Like,
biological family, I guess we would say.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I was just thinking about this. For someone like Steve, who was so, in some ways, incredibly open. I mean, like literally, his door was always open.
That's right.
Right. You could just walk in and start talking, start hanging around. There's a lot about him I didn't know.
Did you know he was a paratrooper?
I had just found that out. I did a podcast with him about 2 months ago.
Oh, you did. Great. Yeah. Did that.
And, great. I've known Steve for, I met Steve in 1986.
Well, right before I did.
So, and hung out with him a lot over the next 10 years or so, you know, was hanging out on the stoop and all that stuff. And it really struck me when I was doing this podcast with him and asking him questions about, like, oh, so, you know, how'd you come to New York? That I'd never known any of that stuff. He told me he was in the army and that he was, like, you know, in London and all, you know, and I had no idea.
I had no idea till this week. I don't know anything about that chapter at all.
Right. Which is funny, right? But I mean, it's, I think, to his credit that he never was, like, talking about that stuff.
No.
Like, oh, are you know, like, you know, when I was prompting him, he was telling me he was, like, hanging around with, like, people like Chester Himes and James Baldwin.
Listen to the podcast. I can find it, right, on Sensitive Skin if I go back.
Yeah, you can find it there or on, like, any podcast network on your phone or whatever. But, yeah, it was really – so, I mean, but as I was thinking about it, and I think it's much to his credit that – he was talking about what's going on now.
Yes, always, right. Always.
And what are we going to do? What are we going to do next, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Absolutely. Right through, always. Yeah. And he never, this is something I said, he complained about money, of course, all the time. Money was for, not personal, but for tribes. He never once complained about any of the physical or other disasters that befell him. Never. Not a word.
That's really true, too. I mean, he took, like, I was there when he was, like, in the process of going blind.
Yeah, me too.
And he was just very graceful about it, I guess is the word.
Courageous.
Courageous, yeah.
So here we are.
Here we are. Yeah, it's really sad because I hadn't spoken to him in ages, and before we did the podcast, I called him and we just spoke on the phone for a couple of hours and we're catching up. I don't think I'd seen him since I moved out to, or spoken to him since I moved out to California 12 years ago. So
I think I met you at Tribes. I think the first time I met you. I'm absolutely sure of it.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's the first time I met. First time I met a lot of people. I met a lot of people there. And it was either tribes or we were hanging. I mean, there was like the triangle. There was tribes, and across the street was the Living Theater.
And a Eureka.
And the Eureka down the street, right? So we were just kind of used to just, like, bounce between those three places. You know, hang out with Ferris at the Living Theater and then, you know, go across the street and see what Steve was doing. And then in the evening, go and see whatever show was going on at the New York.
Right. It was a great time. And you got that feeling on Sunday. You just felt all of that kind of energy is a terrible word. But yes, that kind of, all those people, all that stuff taking off, taking fire, really.
Yeah. So. And it's just also great to see how many young people he continued to bring in.
Yes, and they were the most moving in many ways. Yeah. They cried, and that was great, and were very vulnerable and talked about everything that he did for them. And most of them I didn't know, really.
Yeah.
Incredible.
Yeah. It makes me want to reach out more to young kids, because I was thinking about it. So 1986, I was a young kid in 1986, you know.
Right.
And it was
very good, though, Bernard.
Oh, thank you. And you too. But sure. Luckily, yeah. good that this is audio only. That's what I always tell.
Yes, right.
Tell
I thought about it. I thought, should I put on makeup a little just for Bernard? And then I thought, oh, yeah, a little, but you don't have to do it all.
Yeah. But I mean, that was part of his thing, too, when he started Tribes, was very explicitly. It's like there's the older cats around, like me and John and, you know, and I don't know who else, David Hammonds.
He was really.
Yeah, definitely.
And
you know, and Bob Holman and all those guys. And he's like, I've got all these people who everybody knows, so I can get some recognition for the mag. But then I want to bring in you young guys, you know, I want to, like, pass this torch to the next generation.
And now we and you all are, like, you know, and they're all 20, 20-something.
Yeah, yeah. So now, like, I'm about the same age that Steve was when I met him.
Yes, so, that's right.
Yeah. That's right. I'm unfortunately in no position to have a salon in my house, I don't think. Not yet, anyway.
You have two kids, right?
Yeah, and my younger daughter's leaving for college.
You're kidding.
So we're about to be empty nesters.
Oh, my God.
Semi-empty nesters, because they'll, you know, especially with the younger one, there'll be some bounce back from, you know,
all right,
Christmas and summer vacation. She's going to CalArts.
That's great.
She's very excited. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, she's very excited, and thank goodness she got a gigantic scholarship, because it's very expensive.
Yes, people were telling me who have, same thing as you, kids of college age. When my son was college age, I think it cost about half, maybe even less than it does now.
Yeah, no, it's
less than half. Yeah.
Do you want to hear what it is, all in?
Sure.
It's $70,000.
Yeah. And some places are 80.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And that's per year, and
it's mind-boggling.
It's mind-boggling.
It's impossible.
It's impossible. Well, it's not impossible if you're, you know, of a
Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, yeah. If you have Jeff Epstein kind of money, you can do it. Yeah.
Oh, my.
Good Lord!
There's a can of worms, right?
There's a can of worms. I kind of love that story, because it just points out, like, the world we're living in right now, the bifurcated world we live in, where you see, like, Republicans are talking about, like, he was friends with Bill Clinton, and Bill Clinton flew on his jet 26 times. And meanwhile, on all the liberal sites, there's pictures of Trump and Jeff Epstein, and him saying, I love that guy. He likes the young ladies. And, you know, and it's like,
he does like them very young, he said, which were on the younger side. I believe that's an exact quote.
Yeah. And it's just, perversion is bipartisan, clearly.
Very good. Right there.
Maybe this is what we need to bring the country back together, you know.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah, but it's kind of saddening to see that, like, this is the way the story is being covered.
Yes, right. There's much more, like, the victims and what he did to them. It's
and
wealth and all of that.
And the wealth, but I guess, getting back to what we're talking about, the really fucked up part about it is, like, oh, this guy's hanging around with Bill Clinton and Donald Trump. As well as they also talked about Prince Andrew, Alan Dershowitz, Kevin Spacey. There's a, you know, good character reference for you, right? Which you might not have thought anything about 3 years ago, and now you're like, oh, Kevin Spacey was there too, and I'm just wondering, like, so what other people was this guy connected to?
Tons,
right? And they're desperately trying to cover their trail and bury this story.
That's right. That's why it's an important story, really.
Yeah.
I mean, for many reasons and on many levels. At first, I thought, well, this is a distraction, but that's not entirely true.
Right.
I think it hits on all kinds of.
Yeah.
Or important is, my vocabulary is not functioning. Important, we'll say. Significant stuff.
Yeah.
That goes on, that is ongoing here, I guess. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And the other thing that I've been hearing, people are starting to talk, and again, I'm not seeing this in, like, covered in, like, the Times or whatever so much. Maybe they just started talking about it, but this whole idea was that he was a hedge fund billionaire.
Yeah, but we haven't found out where his money really comes from, and if there really is that much of it, and what the sources of it really are.
Right.
But
apparently that's a friend of mine who's an investigative journalist was posting some stuff on Facebook, and apparently, I mean, it's still an enormous amount of money, but he's not a billionaire. He's worth about $50 million.
Nothing.
Right? Nothing. Bupkis. Bupkis.
Oh, good work.
Love it. And also that there's almost no records of him with the SEC registering as a stock trader. So,
really?
And so, but really what he was a procurer, a pimp for the billionaire class.
And blackmailed people probably. Who knows? He was a procurer. Right.
Yeah. And also turns out he was good friends with the CEO of Victoria's Secret.
Yes. Oh, that was a big friendship.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was like a tie in with that, that like, and I remember when, I lived in Paris for a few years in the '80s.
Remember that.
And, and I would, and I met a lot of models there, you know, it was just, cause I would meet people in the expat community, right?
Right.
I had French friends, but it was also like, as an English speaker, you met a lot of people from all over the world who spoke English, like from Germany or, you know, wherever, you know, Australia, you name it, you know, and they tended to like Argentina, you know, and a lot of them ended up speaking English or you know, coalescing together or whatever. And so I knew a number of models, and it was in some cases close to prostitution.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing, that models were professionalized here by what's her name? Oh God, they've talked about her. I forgot. Anyway, yes, it was.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of these girls were like, a few of them did very well, and then there were the ones who would just like get a few bookings a week, and it was like, oh, would you like some more bookings? Why don't you come out to dinner? There are some friends of mine who are in town. There was like that sort of thing was going on. All the time.
It's a very old story, right?
Yeah.
With women and powerful and not so powerful.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to see that this is changing finally, you know?
I hope so. Not quite.
Yeah. I mean, fact that...
A little bit. It's changed even a little bit.
Yeah. It's changed... I'd say it's changed a lot and a little bit. It's changed. Mm-hmm. It's changed a lot, but there's still a long way to go.
Right.
But I find it kind of fascinating that you know, Epstein was brought up on this shit. When was it? Like in 2008, and they slapped his wrist, right? And that guy then had to resign. The guy Acosta, right? Who? Yeah. But that shows the different world we were living in 2008. And Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and Bill Cosby were all out there doing their thing.
And tons of other people.
And tons of other people, of course, still. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
And then there was... Oh, go ahead. The way
you know, and myself, and it went through all it on some level, in some way, with some... Yeah.
Sure. And then there was the... And didn't somebody put out a couple of years ago, like, the shitty men in publishing industry list or something that? Yeah.
Well, speaking of which, I mean, if we're going to tell this is a podcast, everybody knows this. I've told this story, I think, but it's true. You know, the writer, what's his name? I tell it as a surprise story, so I'll try doing it that way. So we'll get to the punchline, which maybe you'll guess. So there was a party, because I went to Michigan, at Donald Hall's house, his first wife and he, and they gave great parties, you know.
Whose house? I didn't catch
Donald Hall, you know, the poet. He just died.
Okay.
Hall, he was poet laureate, and this is Michigan. And so this was a party for a poet, very well known poet, who then wrote a novel. That's why I'm making it like a, you know, a punchline thing. So he's a big Southern guy, very big, very Southern. Everybody's drinking and all of that stuff. And he said, I choose at every party. Let's see if I can. I won't do the accent right. I choose at every party one 19-year-old, one 29-year-old, and one 39-year-old. So I wasn't quite 19, but I guess I was the 19-year-old. So this guy's an asshole. And I moved away. And I was with my boyfriend, who you might know, was Tom Clark, who recently got run over, who moved to California, was a great poet also. Anyway, so finally I went upstairs to put my coat on, and someone jumped me, held me down on the bed, and I kicked him in the groin, and I screamed, and I screamed, and I screamed, and Tom, thank God, heard me, and he came running up the stairs and saved me, because I would have been raped. It was James Dickey.
Wow.
And the next day he came to the head of the stairs at Hall's house and he said, "That girl, she sure didn't like me." And last year, I wrote to Donald Fallon and I told him the story. He said, "I never knew that happened. I didn't know what, you know," he certainly wasn't going to talk about it. Right.
Yeah.
And he must have done this to tons of people. Right. So, Hey, people have much worse stories.
Yeah.
Than that.
Yeah. And everybody's got, and like you said, everybody's got a story right. like that. Or like Shavisa Woods, 100, you know, she's got her 100 stories. And
she was great. She really saved Steve at the end, and she was great on Sunday. They did a great thing.
Yeah. Who put it together? Was it Bob?
She and Bob Holman really put it together.
Yeah.
Right. And Danny helped too. I think Danny shot. They were the main two. Yeah, it was extraordinary.
And were people like eulogizing him or reading or?
People did various things. I spoke a little bit about him and then I read from his book, that great book, you know, Groove, Bang, and Jive Around.
Yeah.
It's an amazing book. Danny read a poem of his. Most people talked about experiences and then some people kind of wrote performance poems or Viney Burroughs did a whole African folklore thing, and Mike Tyler wrote a song, and people did different things. You know, it started out quiet and very vulnerable, and then it sort of got very New Yorkican and raucous, which was kind of great too.
So how did you end up in New York?
I was born in New York. I was born.
I can kind of hear it. I can kind of.
I think I knew, but I don't remember. Bookus, where are you from?
I was born in Providence, Rhode Island.
Oh, which is beautiful, actually.
Now it is.
It wasn't so much.
Yeah, it used to be the armpit of the East Coast.
I thought that was New Jersey. No.
Well, you got to have two armpits, right?
Yeah, right. Nice. You should be a writer.
Maybe one of these days.
I grew up in the Bronx, which is, yes, you can tell, right? But my parents were, my mother was an artist. My father was a firefighter, but he loved the arts. He loved theater, actually, most. And, if you're from the Bronx, you grow up in the street. So what was
their background, though? Were they born?
They were from the Bronx also.
Oh, they were born in the Bronx. Okay.
Yes. My grandparents were the immigrants on both sides. Yeah.
From where?
My mom's side was from Odessa and Kiev. So my mom had red hair and her father had, you know, that Odessa Jewish red hair. I think, had red hair, right? And my father's family was more from the shtetl, you know, the Poland, what was Poland, who knows what it is, that middle corridor, I think.
So we're probably related.
That would be wonderful.
Well, you know, I'm sure if you just went back, you know.
Right.
You know, a couple of hundred years is a common ancestor there, at least.
That's
right. Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
That's
I had some of that red hair in my family, too.
Do you? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Not in any of the current generations, but I remember my mom talking about it. Like, yeah, so and so. My grandfather had red hair. And yeah.
Oh, yeah. So we know where were they from originally?
Kharkov.
Where is that?
In the Ukraine.
Odessa and Kiev are the Ukraine too.
That's my dad's side, and my mom's side was again the Polish shtetls. I can't remember the name of the tiny little town.
Oh, you do better than
in.
I have no.
I've got it written down somewhere, but yeah.
Good. So, and my grandmother, on my dad's side, when she came here, you know, they all worked in the garment district.
Mm-hmm.
They all.
The schmata business.
The schmata, yeah, you good. Can you speak Yiddish?
I probably know, maybe 100 words.
That's more than I do. Yeah. I know about 10.
Oh, come on. You've lived in New York your whole life and you do, you know?
Maybe I know 20.
Oh,
Yeah.
like, you know, come on. Everybody's lived in New York knows 20 Yiddish words. Come
Yeah,
on.
okay. But I don't know as many as you. Or if I do, I don't, they, you know, like when you said them, I went, Anyway, I ended up at music and art. Not that I want, by that time, I just wanted to be a rock. I just wanted to be tough. I didn't want to have anything to do with anything leftist or artistic. I just wanted to wear a leather jacket, you
So,
know.
rebelling against your artistic parents, basically.
No, but my mother didn't want me to go to Taft, very wisely. So she said, okay, if you go to the Art Students League, you can go on the subway by yourself. So that was the, what's it called? The bribe, I guess. What is it called? So I went and I loved it. And I got into music and art and I loved it. I loved it. All everybody was like me, crazy, and New York and artistic and from all the outer boroughs and inner boroughs and yeah. It was wonderful. And then I went to Michigan, and then I ended up in England for 4 years.
Oh, what were you doing in England?
I followed my boyfriend, the poet, Tom Clark, although we broke up and my parents didn't know. Elaine Eckery thinks it's a great story, you know, that we eloped. I guess we kind of did, although I didn't think of it. I went to Girton College, Cambridge, and then London School of Economics because they took me, and it was like £60 for the whole year. They said, fine, you know. Yeah, sure. Register. I mean, that was the, and it was great. I loved it. It was amazing. And I saw who I've written about this too. I saw, I'm showing my age, which you're not supposed to do, but fuck. The last completed speech Malcolm X gave was at LSE. You can look it up. It was on a Friday.
Really?
Yep. And I had seen this Oak Tag sign saying Malcolm X presented by the African Students Union, because it was very, there were students from all over the world, you know, that was really. And so I said, well, you know, I'll check it out if it's not really him. But so I got to the building and there's this, the tallest, thinnest, but he looked like a Giacometti in motion. He really did. He had on his trend and it was clearly him, you know. And he, and it was packed. Which surprised me. It was a little Oak Tag. I was there were people hanging off the balcony, you know, in saris and all kinds of, you know, outfits from Africa. There were kids from the United States, all over. And he started by doing jokes, you know, the joke. He had just come back from Mecca. So this is when he was changing, you know, so he talked about the change that not all white people were devils and at the and he said he sat that next to a woman on the plane. And, you know, he said, what's your name? And she said her name. And she asked him his name. And, you know, Malcolm, she said, oh, Malcolm, what? And he said, Malcolm X. And she went, ah! And then he went into his rap. And that was, they made us hate our eyes. They made us hate our noses. They made us hate our mouths. They made us hate our skin. And my head just spun around because that was the first time, no matter who you thought you were or how accepting you thought you were, you suddenly got in that instant how people, you know, how people were, are perceived and seen and what that does to you. So it was incredible. And then on Monday, because he got heckled a lot over some stuff he said. He said some pretty upsetting stuff too. Early on. And
Like what?
it was about Hitler. He said he won, didn't he? And these kids from Northern England really got on him and heckled him, and he wasn't used to that, and he blushed. Absolutely
Wow.
blushed. And
Well, he's
the
right. I
you
mean,
figure?
well, look who's the president of the United States now. We got fucking Nazis marching and
That's true. Well, he didn't win completely, and maybe there's more hopeful things for the story to be told. That's what we work for, pray for. Anyway, on Monday, so I'll just do a postscript. The chief heckler, the redheaded, he was a redheaded kid from Northern England, And he came running into the common room, tears pouring down his face. And he said, Malcolm X has been killed. Malcolm X has been killed. And LSC was the first overseas place that sent flowers to Betty Shabazz. So, yeah, that's that story.
Okay. Wow.
And then I came back. After 4 years, I meant to go for one, but I loved it. I had a great time. So I got a degree in economic history. So I think my degree is in economics. I know nothing about economics. Nothing.
Did you learn it and forget it, or did you just never even
learn
it?
No, but I learned a lot about United States economic history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating. Yes, I did. I learned a lot. Yeah, it was great. And I traveled, you know, all that stuff that I'm sure you did too, right? You were in Paris and you must have gone to other places.
Yeah.
And then I came back here and basically became an actress.
Mm-hmm.
And
were you doing plays or?
Oh, yeah. Sure. I did stuff of Amiri's. That's another story. Amiri did a play. And this was later. So this was, I know exactly when it was. 75. He did a play called Sydney Poet, which was, the first act was this incredible satire, basically about Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier. Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte had a song. I played Harry Belafonte's, except he was called Larry Elephant. So I started the show, I am Queen of the Nile. And then I went into this whole thing. And opening night, he got me up against the wall, more or less. And he said, you open the show. All of the energy has to come from you. And he went on and on. And I was like terrified. And then I thought, Juice, because the character's name was Juice. I thought, that's sex. That's electricity. That's, you know. So I went out there. I am Queen of the Now. But Larry Elephant had a song called Whitey, My Main Man. I give him everything I can. And this show was sold out. It was great. We moved it to Third Street next to what then became New Eureka Poets Cafe.
Mm-hmm.
And it was wonderful. And during rehearsal, Count Stovall, who played Larry Elephant, said, you know, Eve, you're gaining weight. And I said, oh, you know, I always gain weight in rehearsal, blah, blah, blah. But I was 5 months pregnant by the time the show opened. Yeah. So... And you have a little kid and you have no money, it's almost impossible to be an actress.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's easier now, but I doubt it.
I doubt it too.
Yeah. Maybe it's harder, actually.
Yeah,
it's impossible.
I think everything is harder unless you're at a certain strata, you know.
Of money,
you mean,
financially.
Yeah.
Yes, I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're right. There was huge off Broadway. I mean, you didn't get paid, but you know, you threw the costumes together and whatever.
Yeah.
I got paid for that show, something. Anyway, but you can't. You can't, you know, you find out there's an audition at 2 p.m. and it's snowing and you have, which happens, and you have a child. So then I sort of became a performance artist through Studio Recherche, which was Ruth Malachek and Lee Brewer, which was an amazing, amazing place on St. Mark's. You probably went by it 5,000 times. It was on 8th Street, St. Mark's, between 1st and A. And then it closed. But that's how I became a writer. Mm-hmm. Are you interested in this? Is this what?
Yeah, this is fascinating. Yeah, I'm getting.
Because I was a performer. I had never written a word. I didn't. And I mean, you know, in school, you have to write papers. I certainly had never written a poem or a performance or a play.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a magic space. I went in as they had this festival of. And so I went in as an actress in somebody else's piece, and I loved it. So the only way I could stay was if you wrote your own stuff. It was a development space for like musicians or dancers or actors to write their own stuff. So, you know, when Spalding Gray came and did Swimming, that would like to test it out and all this. So the first piece I wrote, I did with my 6-year-old son, and it was about the predicament, which is in the newspapers all the time now, of being basically by then a single mother with a kid. And he did it with me until kind of couldn't. We put him on video. They were very into video.
Yeah. And that was a different time, too.
Whatever.
Yeah.
That's the 80s.
I mean, my cousin had a kid on her own in probably around that time, like 1980 or something like that. Maybe even a little earlier. And she's still around. She's something, but she had a boyfriend who was like the UN representative from Palestine for a while.
Really?
And then she ended up, she traipsed through South America, and she ended up with having a kid with a Sandinista.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. And anyway, but didn't want to marry the guy for lots of reasons, you know, and
I was married.
Oh, okay.
And then divorced.
Divorced. Yeah. But anyway, but long story short, like half my family disowned her.
That's horrible.
It's horrible. Yeah. But it was just like such a scandal back then to like, you're having a kid, you're not married. And, you know, it's just
when she needed all the support she could get.
Yeah. Yeah. My parents were very supportive of her, which.
Right.
Yeah. But, but other members of the family were, oh, how can you besmirch our family name with such a scandal? It's a Shonda.
A Shonda, that word I know. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, but she but it all ended up all right.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
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 So then Rechercher closed. Lee and Ruth just didn't want to do it anymore. They wanted to go on to do other things. So I did four altogether. Four performance pieces, of which and they were all very different. And it was great. I could have stayed there forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But you started writing. It seemed like
I had to start. Yes, that's how I became a writer. I really became a writer because I had a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Really, that's so. When people say, "Oh, it keeps you from," and the first piece I did was about that. In a certain way, it pushes you to become maybe something else.
Yeah.
Without my son, I wouldn't have written a word.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. I have quite a few friends who decided for whatever reason never to have kids, and you know, they look at me and like what I go through sometimes, and they go, "Oh man, I feel sorry for you." And I was like, "There's pluses and minuses.
Yes,
it's definitely changes you, gives you new insights into empathy." You know, I mean, one of the things I think having kids really changed for me was my feelings and resentments towards my own parents. And it made me forgive them for a lot of the things that they did.
That's very, very true. And God knows we all make mistakes.
Of course.
That we don't even know we're doing all these really horrific things.
Yeah.
And you haven't. Yeah. You probably haven't, but I did.
Yeah. And you find yourself, of course, repeating the pattern sometimes, like doing the exact same things that your parents did. And hopefully you stop yourself and go, "Oh, wait a minute. No, let's break this chain. Let's break this cycle right now."
You've got to remind yourself to do that, right?
Yeah.
And then there's other things that you try to do very differently, like with my son, because it's so complicated, but my mother discouraged, she was an artist, so she didn't want me to be an artist. Who knows? You know, we're not going to. But she did everything to discourage me from being in the arts. So with my son, I've done everything to encourage whatever he wants to do.
Yeah.
But I made lots of other terrible mistakes.
So. Yeah. I'd say they're pretty much the same for me. You know, it's like my parents had a plan for me.
Right.
That they had everything worked out, what I should do and what I would be really good at. And then.
What was the plan?
Well, they wanted me to like go to medical school and be a doctor. Yeah. You know,
I was supposed to be a teacher, which I sort of did.
Yeah, I mean, I was like, took me a while to be able to finally say, no, I don't want to do I don't want to do that.
Meisler, it sounds good, though.
Dr. Meisler. Well, that was my father. My dad was a doctor. So,
oh, he was.
So he wanted me to, you know, whatever. Oh, yeah. This would be a good thing for you. Whatever. And I would have been a terrible doctor.
Well, you might not have been, but you're great at what you do. So, hey.
Well, there you go. Yeah. But I think I would have been a terrible doctor because the good doctors are all about like the bedside manner. And I think, you know, I would just get irritated by sick people complaining.
I don't know. Who knows?
Maybe I would have been Dr. House and figured out, like, you know.
Who knows?
I'm really glad I didn't do that.
I'm glad you didn't do it either, or we wouldn't be here doing this wonderful thing.
Yeah.
What are your books there, by the way? I see them all, so tell me what some of them are.
It's funny that you asked that because I was just, like, the half hour before we started this, I was actually looking through my books, trying to find a book that I couldn't find. I wanted to find Jim Boughton's Ball 4.
Because, okay, he just died.
Because
right?
he just died, and that was a book
and you
I
have
had.
It.
I had a book I had when I was like 12 or what. That's like I read it when it came out, and to be like a 12-year-old baseball fan,
right?
Like
right.
really into that sort of thing, and then just kind of about to like drop all sports for other pursuits kind of thing. It was like the perfect sort of thing to, you know, it's because it's about baseball, sex and drugs, that book. Right?
Oh, is that right? I should read it again. I think I did read it.
It was scandalous when it came out because nobody had ever talked about like, you know, but like, I don't know that Mickey Mantle was a drunk and that, you know, so whatever. And,
all
that crazy stuff. But anyway, I was looking through my books. I can't find it. I think what's happened is that like every time I've ever moved, there's been a whole bunch of books boxed up and one box gets lost.
Yeah. So, or maybe certain books disappear from my shelves or certain when I used to have records, you know, in the dark ages before the invention of the wheel. If there was ever Sketches of Spain or Kind of Blue in the house and I gave a party.
Yeah.
God.
Yeah. That also used to happen too. But, if anybody ever asks me if they can borrow a book, I tell them no, or I will give it to them.
Yes. In England, speaking of which, it was a tradition because they keep their doors open and anybody can come in and take your book and don't ever expect to see it again. So if there are books you don't want taken, you just don't leave them out on the shelves.
Yeah, yeah.
You put them somewhere.
Interesting.
Else.
Yeah, but it's funny. I was looking through this, and it's so weird. I have books from when I was a child. Like I have some of the first books I ever read, like The War of the Worlds and The Jungle Book and Jules Verne stuff, The Mysterious Island, the stuff
I remember that
loved
stuff.
To read when I was like really young, and then stuff from high school. Like a lot of, I was reading like Kurt Vonnegut and stuff like that, and stuff from college, like all the heavy literature started coming in the college days, and it's weird. So there's stuff there from like every era of my life.
You must
but
have
there's...
a big house, Bernard.
No, I don't. I have a big, I just have a wall of books, and there's another wall of books over there, and there's a bunch of books laying all over the place in disarray.
But it's a house.
It is a house. So it's bigger than a New York City apartment.
Yeah, because that's the thing. I have a pretty big apartment, but I got to have more bookshelves. We try to throw things out. Yeah, it's big. As you know, it's a big thing.
Yeah, I call every once in a while.
Good.
You know,
good
and I say, like I say, this one, and I just give them to the library or to Goodwill or whatever. You know, and then there's been a few times where I've regretted that. I was like, where's my copy of?
I know. Away, Joyce Johnson, minor characters, and I'm so sorry. I gave it to someone I liked, but I shouldn't have given it away because it's a wonderful book. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Steve's book, which I have, which I bought at his book party, which was in 1996, and he signed, it looks like. I knew just where to find it. I went first right because it's a very distinctive spine, and I picked it right up. I'm looking at it now.
I know I had a copy. Whether it's still here is up for debate. You know, yeah. There's one cool shelf down there that's really packed. That's that I love because it's getting more and more packed. I'm going to have to take over a second shelf, and it's just books by my friends.
Oh, I have. That's me too. Many, but and everything gets jumbled, right?
Yeah.
And you stack them, and they.
Yeah, but I tried to put all of those in one place so I can find them. So I really like that shelf. That shelf makes me happy seeing all that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. How are we doing on
time? So I'll quickly talk about how I got to be a poet very fast.
Okay.
So I had been with this poet who's a great poet, and he was, when I was with him and we were very young, Donald Hall made him editor of the poetry editor of the Paris Review.
Oh, wow.
So he would tell me about, you know, Amiri, who was Leroy Jones then, or he would introduce me to Ed Dorn, or he did the interview with Allen Ginsberg, who stayed at our house. That's a story I left out, but he did. That's a story, if we have time, I could tell, go back. Anyway, I don't remember. So, and he showed me, this is Robert Creeley, or he was corresponding with Ron Padgett and all those people. So I had read this, and it was Beckett, you know, read this, it was the Cantos. So I had an education and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But I certainly wasn't going to do it. And then Bernadette Mayer wrote something, and I was acting with Medicine Show, and I was in it, and Ratio Shade closed, and I had nowhere to go to write. I had nothing. That was like my home base, you know? And she said, oh, I'm doing a poetry workshop at St. Mark's. Why don't you come? So I did. And all kinds of people. Les Bridges was in that workshop and all kinds of other wonderful people. And that opened the whole world. That's really where it started.
Mm-hmm.
And
all right. So, now that you mention it, you got to tell me your Allen Ginsberg story, because it sounds like it's a good story.
It's a good story. Yes, part of it is a really good story. And then it has postscript that's, all right, so I'll do this very fast. So we were young. It was the spring, and Tom went and got Allen, and it was pouring rain when they came back. That I remember. It was like, even though it was May, I guess. It was, and they came in the house, and we had this upstairs little apartment. There was one room, and then there was kind of a big kitchen.
So this was in London, or?
No, this was in Cambridge, Newmarket Road.
Okay.
And so there was a poet named Elaine Feinstein, I think that was her name, and she came in the pouring rain with her husband and her baby, and they all went in the other room because they were the poets, and I was the girlfriend. So that was the first night. Second day, dawn, Saturday, dawn, beautiful, sunny. I walked out with Alan, who was very clean and a great house guest. And he was on his way to the Blake Library because he was going to spend the entire day looking at Blake. And the streets were lined with people and young men, too, from, I'd say, Asian countries, probably, but all kinds of people from all over the world. And they were literally lining the street and waving. To me, I had barely heard of him, but in Europe, he was a culture hero already. So he studied all day, and that night he gave a reading with his in the King's College Library, and he played his finger cymbals. It was a wonderful reading. And then, I don't know if I should tell, I have to, you know, I'll tell. He went to, we had lots of African friends, and one of them had been a runner in the, like, all run game. So he was beautiful. And Alan went to kiss him on the mouth. And you don't do that to a proud African man in front of his friends. Sir, and that time. And he went for his throat. The guy went for his throat. And the fight had to be broken up. And it was all right after that. Then there were two parties, and Alan and Tom got invited to one. I got invited to another. I stayed out most of the night. And I came back, and Alan said, "We know what you were doing." I said, "No, no, no. I was dancing the high life all night long." And then he took me to a restaurant. He was very kind to me. Tom and I were having some awful problems. We really weren't getting, things were, you know how it is, yeah. pre-breakup sort of, kind of. He was very kind to me. And he said, he was the first person who ever said to me, you know, follow your heart. I mean, now it's a big truism, but I had never heard it. It was the first time I heard it. He also said, I know why you're so good with kids, because they're the only people you can boss around. Because, you know, very small. And he was very sweet. He was, and then this is the addenda to the whole thing. On Monday, there was a reading in the King's College Chapel. All right, this will have a surprise punchline too. So this very elegant gentleman in a gray fitted Italian suit sat down. And all of us people who had been sort of fighting and crazy over the weekend sat very quietly, and the light was coming through the stained glass windows. And he read in Spanish, which I speak Spanish, but I could only understand some of it. And he just read very quietly, but it was truly magic. And it was Pablo Neruda.
Huh?
So that's the story of
nice
that.
Nice postscript. Yeah.
What?
Nice postscript.
Yes, right? Yeah. Like I've written about it. It's called The Greatest Weekend.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want to read us something?
Sure. Do you want something recent, older, outrageous? Tell me.
All of the above sound good.
What?
All of the above sound good to me.
All of the above sound good. So should I start with something outrageous or not outrageous? I'm trying to think how I'm going to do this. Oh, I know. I will start, and then I'll go back in time. I'll start with, I have to put my glasses on. It's awful. I can't read now without them. You're not there yet? You can read without your glasses, Bernard? Okay. We'll get used to it. 1:28:17, 4:18 p.m. We'll get used to it. We won't even notice. We'll get used to the dictator, Caudillo, strongman, boss by edict, executive action, fiat. We'll get used to it. We won't notice alternative facts, lacks of checks and balances, erasure of three-branch government, zip, freedom of press, no open door for immigrants, no Roe versus Wade, no health care insurance. We won't notice the girl kids dying, bloody coat hangers up their pussy, the kids with no parents, the parents with sick kids, spike in asthma, smog, pollution, the sleepers on subway grates, sleepers on the subway, the breakdown in the subway, the roundups and shootings, radioactive holocaust, the hurricanes and sharp winds unending, the dead polar bears, the dead seas and hummingbirds, the planet on fire. It won't be us. It won't be our daughter. Fever and bloody sepsis. It won't be me sleeping on the subway grate. It won't be my hijab caught and ripped at the gate. It won't be my son, grandkids rounded up. It won't be us caught in nuclear bombing, drowned city. We'll get used to it. We won't even notice. We're dead. So I guess I wrote that shortly after Trump was inaugurated, 8 days after. Now we will go back in time. So in the 90s, after a bad breakup with someone who you knew very well, who we don't have to mention his name, but that's how Tom Form. Who did introduce me to some great things and great people. But we won't go there.
And he passed away like 10 years ago or something,
no,
right?
No, not that long ago.
Wasn't that long ago?
Yeah. 3 years ago, yeah. Actually. I believe of a stroke. So I spent a lot of time. I swim at 43rd Street, so kind of I would teach. I was a home instruction teacher for 5 million years. I'm retired, and I teach. And it was a good job for someone who does something else, because it's the field, you know? So, cut corners, at least at the beginning. Then they got very strict. That's another story. And now I'm an adjunct. at Westchester Community College. Meanwhile, I'm looking for the pages. I'm sorry. Come on, E. I'm just wasting time, right? Here we go. Ah, all right. All right, I'll read the... Huh? Why is it not here? Where is it? All right, I don't even have to read it. I really know it. I'll read the... All right, this has been... Yeah. Okay, so I spent a lot of time at 42nd Street. But I would ask at Sally's, which is the famous transvestite bar on 43rd. And next to it was Dave's, which was a gay bar and a reporter's bar where Taylor Mead used to hang out. And there were all, you know, playpen. And I wrote about, I would ask what is love or questions like that and pay people for their time or drinks or whatever. So this is at Sally's. Sylvia Del Rio is stacked and sits at the circular bar in her long black spaghetti strap dress, long bleached auburn hair, cat's eye mascara, wide and gorgeous mouth. A whiff of drive you wild in your face, perfume and performance, tossing her head, shrugging a shoulder, arm on my arm, leg on my leg. Ava Gardner, Silvana Mangano, Raquel Welch, overblown and hot. I'm a pre-op transsexual. She writes in my book, a she-male is someone that looks like a woman, but rally a faggot, F-A-G-I-T. Transvestite, spelled travesty. Someone who is a hard, hard man who fantasizes at being a woman. Pre-op transsexual, someone before she chop off her dick. In July, she broke up with her boyfriend. He doesn't pay homage anymore. I'm a queen. He's a liar. Getting fat. Missing a tooth, lazy, what would make you happy? Stiletto dropping a dime, hard as nail, hitting bullseye, she says. Someone to share my life, appreciate me. If you can't do that, you're a piece of shit. Give me my trophies, you're out. As I go, she tells me her phone number. You can suck my dick anytime. Round and soft and full moon, New York Times clock reads 6:34. Very warm for January.
All right, now how about something outrageous?
Yes. Yes, so tell me what kind of thing you'd like to hear, outrageous or otherwise. Oh, I'm going to read a 9/11 since this is a podcast.
Okay.
I am going to read, this is poem, the first time. We were all scheduled to have a reading in Steve Cannon's beautiful garden on East 3rd Street. And it was scheduled for, I think, sometime right after 9/11. And we had the reading anyway. And so it must have been after 9/14, because this is called 9/14 St. Vincent Hotline. And it was Steve Cannon's favorite poem of mine. And it's in Word, actually. It's now called, it has a different title. Fewer callers, callers beginning to get through from overseas. And now the children are calling, not tiny kids, but 10, 11, 12. You can hear the baby crying or the adult. The kids only want to speak English or are calm enough to take down information. And from a child, I hear, do you have the morgue number, the address of the morgue? There's a little girl named Amarillo. I think it's Amarillo. Is there a list, Ed?
I thought they were done.
Yeah, both of them were done.
Let's hold on a minute. We can always. I'm gonna edit this anyway. So
yeah.
let's do one. Let's do one more, and then we'll wrap up because it's
recent one. Yeah, I'll do.
If you do the 9/11 one, that's fine.
Yeah, it was okay. It was with the lawnmower. It was kind of good. I like. I don't mind. It was kind of fit, and we ended together. The lawnmower and me. So, yeah, there are some very recent. There are short ones and long ones. This is one I wrote, I made, I don't like to say wrote, I made in the spring. It's called Hudson Yards, Day One. It's Hudson Yards, Day One. Shut up. What a jerk to drag a friend to Hudson Yards the day after it opens. Today, St. Patrick's Day in the city, bursting with drunk green people. Over here on the west side, we join masses streaming through, knock you down and toss you over winds, unfinished beams barely held in place. And here we are, caught in nightmare video phantasmagoria. Particles in the parade, desperate to be the first to Instagram the sculpture, selfie them all, march through it all, and social media at home. No one can afford what's selling here or can afford to live here. We just gawk at, as my friend says, the inhumaneness of it, the inhumanness of it, the scale built for skyscraper heroes clad in Metallica, not one bookstore or affordable joint to eat, no place to live, no place to hide, no place to find a quirky, personal, doodle, signature corner. I'm trying to think what Hudson Yards reminds me of, and then I remember. Ginsburg's Moloch, whose eyes are 1,000 blind windows, the mob in Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust, rushing towards what dream of fame. These yards, a monument, an altar, not to the human spirit or human flaws. These are yards, a monument to mammon. All that's missing, a sky-high golden calf. Soon, baby, soon. And our entrails, hard-earned cash, fed to the eternally ravenous $250 billion beast.
Very nice. That was in our last poetry special, I believe.
That's right. Yeah.
So,
that's right.
Folks, you can find it online if you want to read it.
I end with something cheerful-er, sort of, or do I not have time? You're going to edit it anyway, or how do you feel about it?
Go ahead, one more.
Yeah, it's one pretty more. Short. It was written, you won't get the beginning, kind of. It's also from... I have three books, all of which were published by Tribes. Skullset Samba, Playland, both of which are out of print, though probably there's copies of them floating. New Nails. And then last year I did this, Foss Park, which is an outdoor swimming pool in Somerville, which you might, Somerville's right outside Cambridge. Maybe you know it.
I know of it. I don't know that I've ever been there. Somerville.
Oh, I'm showing you the photo, but the photo won't show. So I wrote this on 8/14/17, 7:19 p.m., and I'll probably change the title or put something. It was written the day after Charlottesville. It's called Foss Park. Oh, it had been a terrible day. Nut job two, Henry Bear, where I did not buy large enough gifts for my grandkids. Then Porter Square Books, no outdoor play, but then and then. My son picks us up and we speed to Foss Park Outdoor Pool. 45 minutes to go, it's 6. And in we jump and the world spins from hot and whiny. The sun about to set, wide expanse of sky. One older woman, two kids, the only other ones in the swim. And Sam, my son, tosses my grandkids, Jupiter and Ozzy, in the air, through the cool water. We are all splashing, and for a flash, so fast, a diamond prism far from the maggots of hate and fear to this alternative galaxy of pure, wet play and delight, bliss.
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 We end with bliss.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Bernard. This is what you do is wonderful. Sensitive Skin was great, is great, will always be great. And these podcasts are very extended and fascinating to listen to.
That's good to hear because I don't know. But I don't know how they are. I can't tell.
They're fabulous. Thank you enormously much, really.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you soon. I hope I see you next time I'm in New York.
Yes, be in touch and have a great summer.
All right, you too.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.